There's way too much for the time that we have allotted, and there should be more that's written that's a history of ourselves and that tries to learn the lessons from it, but I'll at least try to do some stuff that I can do, except that I have the wrong glasses on and I can't read my outline. Now, first we might ask why the 60s happened. There's a million answers to this question, but one, I think, and there is no single answer to this question by any means, but one reason is interesting and is relevant and that teaches an important lesson. When Michael Harrington wrote the book, The Other America, thank you very much, basically revealing poverty in America. And when the women's movement and I guess Betty Friedan's first writings, and when the black movement and various writings, some fiction, some nonfiction, revealed, and also the struggles in the South. In each case, and particularly in the latter two, but in each case, and the anti-war movement and the revelations about U.S. foreign policy, what was happening is a populace was being told there are horrible circumstances and crimes that are socially caused. And this may come as a surprise to some people, but this was a shock to huge numbers of people, including huge numbers of people who even were suffering the crimes, because people felt that the hardships and the suffering and everything else was basically a personal fault. And so the revelation and the collective discussion of the problem was enough to create tremendous anger about it and an upsurge of movement. Now, the trouble is you can't do this twice, because once it's done, or at least I suppose you could after a long period of time, but once it's done and there's an understanding of all the problems and their sources that's pretty deeply rooted and diverse in society, so it isn't shocking people to tell them the things we tell them, which in fact it isn't, then it doesn't inspire the anger and the upsurge of outrage which leads to a movement, because people already know that. This has a lesson for us, which is that we can't do it the same way again. We can't just keep telling people what's wrong and expect them to go berserk and to join movements and to become riled up, because they already know what's wrong. Regarding political ideology, the simple lesson from the New Left for me, these are lessons I took, other people took other lessons, obviously. There was the women's movement, there was black power, there was the anti-war movement, there was hippies, which was a movement that was about stuff that people think has been recently discovered, but consumerism and lifestyle and all the rest of that. And there was an anti-capitalist movement, a workers' movement, a labor movement. All these things existed. And they could all exist only in parallel, or it was possible, we thought at the time, some of us, to try and unite them. The way we did that at the time, and I guess it's a fledgling version of for me, of the kind of stuff that I was trying to do in radical theory classes, was we used to call it the totality of oppressions. And we used to say that there's this totality of oppression. Somebody else came up with that, certainly not me. A friend of mine, though. And this concept meant to cover these various different kinds of oppressions. And then the notion that we had is that this totality of oppressions was intertwined in some way, mutually supportive and causative in some way, and it made sense to address them all in some fashion as best you could, or at least show their links. That was an early version of the kinds of stuff I was talking about in radical theory. In any case, it was an insight that I think was very valuable. The insight was that these movements taken separately don't win. They can't generate enough power, they can't generate enough support, and they can't generate enough internal cohesion either, because without addressing the other problems, those problems creep in and rip them apart. So the understanding we had at that time was that there was some mechanism by which you had to pay attention to each and yet generate some kind of totality. You had to have some kind of autonomy, because you had to have what the women's movement taught was, you know, women needed a room of their own. They needed some room to develop power, an agenda, and to be able to then push it and advance it, for instance, around sexism, even in the movement or in general. Same thing with black power. You had to have an element of autonomy, and it would exist whether one wanted it or not, because the oppressions would cause people to desire to function together and to work together against those oppressions. But you also had to have solidarity. The second thing about political ideology that I learned from the 60s was that there's a good and a bad part of having one. The good part of having one I first learned very early on when I watched the sectarian Marxist-Leninists operate in discussions. And what I learned was that by virtue of having an intellectual framework and concepts and theory, they were quick. They were able to deal with questions. They had answers. They could pursue a point of view. They could communicate together with each other effectively and efficiently because they had a framework in which they thought. I also learned the bad part by watching the same people, which is that it's perfectly possible to have something like that and take it to an extreme of lunacy, in which you think that this language that you have and these concepts that you have are valid and compelling when they're crazy. And so you're all talking the same language and ratifying each other's views, called sectarianism, right? And dismissing anything that diverges from it, and you constantly have answers, but it's all wrong. And a lot of people's reaction was, since that's a possibility, that kind of sectarian behavior, that kind of insular viewpoint, that kind of, you know, an answer for everything, but the answer is wrong, and pigeonholing everything into a framework that's in one's mind, right, and seeing everything that way and missing all the nuance, since that happens, the only thing we can do is get rid of theory. We can get rid of ideology. We can get rid of shared politics, shared framework. This is not the right solution to this problem. The right solution to this problem is to have good theory, good framework, one that is conducive to people being open to new ideas and to correcting itself. Now, that's an insight that I think has some value that came from my experience in the 60s. You can explore it further with yourself. I want to cover a bunch of things, and then we'll have open it up for discussion. There will be some examples, I promise. Regarding tactics, at that time, there were teach-ins. There were rallies. There were sit-ins. There was civil disobedience. There were occupations. There were riots, literally organized riots. There was building occupations or destructions. There were bombings. There were firings. There were painting on the walls of schools. You know, you wake up one morning and everything has been painted with graffiti or whatever. There's all sorts of things. There was throwing dollar bills at people in the, you know, to demonstrate your disdain for consumerism and for the dollar or something. So somebody's speaking and all of a sudden there's dollar bills flying all over the place. There was all kinds of creative and interesting tactics. And the question that what usually would happen was that people would find a few tactics that they liked and think that every other tactic was garbage. Or even find a single tactic. So a rally is what we believe in, or civil disobedience is what we believe in, or bombing is what we believe in, whatever it is, and everything else is patooey. This was often the case, and the lesson that emerged after a while was not only should we be multi-issue in the sense of having a broad political framework that took into account all those various focuses that people had and tried to address the totality of oppression by being multi-issue, but we should also be multi-tactic. Why be multi-tactic? Well, the question arises, why do anything tactical? And the answer, and this also emerged from my experience, at least for me, from the 60s, was that the way you win anything is by raising the social cost. I say that often, but I don't think you can repeat it often enough. Because the way you end the war, which is what we were trying to do at that time, or the way you win affirmative action, which somebody might be doing at some other time, or the way you win higher wages, or the way you do anything at all, as long as we haven't won an entirely new system, in which case you just ask for it and it comes, because we're controlling. But short of that, you have to get the elites to give in. And getting the elites to give in means raising the social cost so high that it's in their interest to give in to what you're saying rather than to persist in what it is that they're doing that you want them to stop or in ignoring your desires. So we have to raise the social cost, and that's what tactics do. That's why you use tactics or you don't use them. They either empower us and make us stronger and make us able to do more next time, raising the social cost, or they raise the cost right now. Now, the only way you can do this is to understand what social cost is. I've talked about this in my classes, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but cost for them isn't harm to humans other than them. They don't care about harm to humans other than them, right? So cost to them isn't the number of corpses piling up in Vietnam, whether it's little kids or adults. It isn't the number of GI corpses piling up. It isn't the number of people who are starving from hunger or disease. None of those things are cost. What's a cost is something which threatens what they hold dear. So what's a cost is if we're doing things which the elaboration of which is moving in the direction that they find harmful. So in Seattle and Washington, why do they get upset? They get upset because they see a process unfolding and they see it more clearly than we do. They see that there's a possible tinderbox there. They see that there's a possible contagion. They see that it's possible that what's going on could lead to growing movements that are challenging the basic things that they hold dear, challenging their authority, challenging their privilege, challenging profit, challenging the institutions, removing people from the system. And they worry that that's going to happen again. And they are really worried about that. And so they organize their efforts to try and prevent it from happening, and we organize our efforts to try and make it happen. And if we're pretty successful, at some point they may decide that one of their ways to make it happen is to simply disband the WTO or even cancel the IMF and the World Bank, which is a harder one to win. We'd have to raise more social costs to win. But that's what we're trying to do, raise social costs. So that was a lesson for me. Another lesson was understanding success. I gave this example, but maybe it bears repeating. If you organize a demonstration and you say, we're going to go to Washington, stop Washington, shut down Washington and stop the war, and you organize everybody. So I'm coming here as an organizer and you're a classroom in a school, and I give this powerful, moving speech about what's happening in Vietnam, and everybody's tearful and we're aroused, right? And then I start to also now discuss the event that's coming up, and I say, and we've got to go to Washington to shut down the city, and everybody goes, yay, and to end the war, and everybody goes, yay. And eventually I've got a fever pitch, and everybody's ready to go to Washington to shut down the city and end the war. Now the trouble is we go to Washington, we shut down the city, we come home the next day, and the war's still going on. So we have a problem here. Because what? Because we've all been organized by the brilliant speaker who's organizing to feel like we want to end the war now. We're going to end the war Sunday, right? And we come home and the war isn't over and we're frustrated. Now, we've had this fantastic demonstration in which we've raised new social consciousness throughout the country. We've developed more infrastructure internally. We've raised our power. We've done all the things you need to do to have a success, but we feel like it's failure. That's one kind of mistake where we don't understand our own success. There's another kind. The war ends. How does it end? Does it end by, you know, Tom Hayden standing on top of the Empire State Building and yelling, it's over, I've ended it? No. It ends by, you know, some president signing a bill that says the war is over. And when he signs the bill that says the war is over, he says he ended the war, despite the obstructions of the anti-war movement. And everybody weeps, right? Because somehow we didn't succeed. We've lost. We have to understand, we have to not, in Hayden's words, grasp defeat from the jaws of victory. Just because the elite takes credit for what we do, just because the, you know, Lyndon Johnson or whoever it is signs the unemployment bill or the affirmative action thing and says it's because they love humanity, we don't lose track of the fact that it's us who want it or that it's movements who want it. Violence and repression. This has come up a little bit. The 60s taught us a lot about this too, I think. Imagine the following. A young person, like some of the young people here, becomes highly politicized, understands the ills of the country, begins to perceive just how vile and disgusting the system is and its perpetrators, through some of the examples that I've given, et cetera, in other presentations. I don't want to repeat everything. And decides that, well, the only thing that's going to win is violence because they're violent. And so they start to go train in shooting rifles, which people did, right? Or they start to figure out that maybe they'll get hurt and they need to be able to deal with it. So one of the conditions for being in the political organization is to operate on oneself. So they cut oneself open people did this. And so they would learn how to stitch themselves up and stuff. And what were they trying to do? Well, they thought that what they were doing, they thought that Armageddon was around the corner and that they were going to wage war with the U.S. Army and the infrastructure of the U.S. police force throughout the country, and because they went to the countryside with a BB gun or maybe some 22 that they got from someplace and managed to hit Cannes once out of 18 times, they were going to beat this army and this police force. Right? Now, I don't want to be too disparaging, but there's a very, very, very serious confusion in the minds, and there's nothing wrong with a serious confusion. We all have serious confusions at some time. But there's a very serious confusion in the minds of anybody who thinks that in the United States, the left is going to beat the military or beat the police. It is not going to happen tomorrow. It is not going to happen in 25 years, 50 years, 100 years, or 1,000 years. It is never going to happen. It will never be the case that there is a left in the United States which is able to fight against the army, unless something happens. The army isn't there to fight against, in which case we won't need to know how to shoot very well. There is only one way to beat the army, which is that the army isn't fighting us. There is only one way to beat the police, which is that the police isn't willing to fight us. So what I learned is that the only real solution vis-a-vis violence, but I'm not going to stop on violence for a minute, but the only real solution vis-a-vis violence, if one is really seriously interested in addressing that part, is addressing the task of what do? You have to build a movement whose character is such that it is very, very difficult to repress it. It's very, very difficult to use violence against it. And then in the act of doing so, the people doing it begin to become disturbed by what they're doing. That's not easy to do, but it is the task, right? So what we have to do, eventually what we have to do is organize inside the police department and inside the army, right? That's the ultimate step. And that's when you know that you're dealing with this issue well. But it's a long, it's a ways off. Is there no condition? Just so people understand something, I'm not a pacifist. I'm not making this argument opportunistically because I really am a pacifist and I really want to try and figure out some way to get people to disavow violence. And I'm going to trick everybody into disavowing violence because I'm not a pacifist. Right? I don't know. I honestly don't know whether, put on the beach in Cuba, I could have gone up into the mountains and shot and killed people. But I like to think I could have. Because I know you had to be able to. I know, that when Che, the doctor, decides that he's going to set aside his medical bag and pick up a rifle, because the rifle is what's necessary in order to treat people medically, that he's right in Cuba. So I'm not a pacifist. I don't believe in nonviolence. But I do understand the world we live in. And in the world we live in the society we live in, anything that is, any notion that we are going to mount a violent force against the powers that be is crazy. On the other hand, let's say there's a strike, and let's say there are scabs, and let's say the scabs want to cross the picket line, and let's say the strikers want to stop the scabs from crossing the picket line. I am not nonviolent. I don't have any problem with, I can easily conceive of, demonstrations and situations in which people are getting bashed who are trying to cross the picket line. And that isn't even bashing cops. That isn't even bashing capitalists. That's bashing perfectly sensible, reasonable, sometimes poor people, right? So there's no single answer regarding violence. So then what is what I learned from the 60s? What I learned from the 60s is the same answer as regarding theory or the same answer as regarding tactics. We're trying to win. We're trying to make change. We're trying to make the world a better place. So what counts is what does that. What counts is what strategically fits. And there are times and places where breaking a window makes sense and times and places where it doesn't. It isn't a big deal. People used to ask me at MIT, would you burn down a library in order to end the war in Vietnam? With audience of, there's 600 students, everybody's gone berserk because we're about to shut down the school. So, hey, if you shut down the school, would you burn down a library to end the war in Vietnam? And I would say back, you fucking moron, would you burn down a library to save a million lives? Of course I'd burn down a library to end the war in Vietnam. With any means I could. Of course I would burn down a library. But naturally, it's a stupid question because burning down a library does not end the war in Vietnam. It's just an idiotic, moronic provocation. So now let's move past the provocation. But the point is, it's not a matter of principle that you don't burn down a library. I wouldn't want to burn down a library. In most instances, I happen to like books, right? So I don't want to burn down a library. But if burning down a library, saves a million lives, of course you do it. But it doesn't. And that's the same answer for going out into the country and learning how to shoot a gun. It doesn't help. And that's the reason not to do it, right? And maybe because you just can't physically do it yourself, which would be another reason to not do it, even if it did help, because you can't do everything. We'll come to that in a minute. Listen, some of the best people in my generation just blew themselves up. This is not a small issue, right? They just blew themselves up along with a few toilets. They weren't doing something useful. It's a tremendous shame, and they weren't fools. Make no mistake, these people weren't stupid, and they weren't deceived, and they weren't tricked, and they were not lacking in sympathy. They were among the most sympathetic, intelligent, creative people
you know, of our generation. But they blew themselves up. So it's not a small issue. There will be recurrence of this over and over again. Once the movement gets to a certain size, it recurs, the issue. And it behooves us, for as many people as possible, to understand. I don't think the pacifist argument will stop it. This argument, I think, can stop it from happening. Because the pacifist argument just will not communicate with the person who looks around and thinks, oh, you got to be violent to fight violence. It just won't communicate. But this may well, because I think this is right. Leadership. What we learned in the 60s about leadership, or at least one of the things we learned in the 60s about leadership, was that, you know, Stalinism isn't leadership. So having an organization in which there is a single leader and in which everybody not only obeys the leader but basically becomes a small clone of the leader, that's what happens in sects, by the way. You know why sects have a sort of a personality? Have you ever engaged with the sects and noticed that they dress alike, they talk alike, they have the same inflections in their voice? Have you noticed that? They use the same phrases? It's because one person, the leaders, dominates and percolates through the whole thing. I can still tell Weatherman 30 years later by the phrases that they use. That's not leadership. I don't know what that is, right? But that's not leadership. But there's nothing. Bad leadership is not the same as exemplary action. Exemplary behavior is good. One doesn't get nervous about exemplary behavior, about creativity, about quality, about intelligence, about hard work, because one's worried that it will metamorphosize into obnoxious leadership. The solution to bad leadership is not to get rid of quality, right? It's to get rid of bad leadership. That's not such a simple lesson, but it's a lesson that I think was learned then. A sense of balance and proportion. I'm sleeping. It's late at night. There's a knock on my door. Four people sort of shrink into the room, you know. Again, these are brilliant people. Can we stay here tonight? What's the matter? We are the Viet Cong, and we're on the run. They meant this. We are the NLF. They saw themselves as if they were the NLF. NLF. I thought I was saying National Football League for a minute. They have become so. You've just lost touch with reality. I mean, they feel like they're somehow in Vietnam. They're creeping around in the dark of night as if the FBI is searching all over for them. The last thing they did was to steal some socks. I'm not kidding. The people who are laughing are people who no doubt were there and who are remembering, right? So if people are laughing and you aren't, it's because, what? Am I correct? Oh. So... You know, you can lose track very quickly of reality. And there are a lot of young people now who think that they are transcending the errors of the 60s. And they say that. And they'll say, like Nadine said, isn't it good that we're past the 60s? Well, let me tell you, people are so far from being past the 60s that it's mind-boggling. And the depressing thing is that it's exactly the part that should be transcended that is rampant. Right, and some of the lessons that are missing. And now the more depressing thing for me is that, of course, that's my fault and the fault of other people like me because we didn't do a good job of relaying the lessons and of teaching. But what was the worst of the 60s? The worst of the 60s was its attitudes to other people in society. The worst of the 60s was the tone that it had with respect to anybody who would dare to buy a consumer product, who was thereby – you know, a part of the devil's system and a consumerist, right? And that tone that emanated from many of us, right, that regarded people as a part of the problem because they wanted to have something in their lives that had some fulfillingness to them, right, or in our views because they wanted to consume the devil's products. We didn't trust anyone over 30. The next thing that we didn't do is we didn't trust our parents. The next thing that we didn't do is we thought that maybe we should just kill them. You know, kill your parents. We went from don't trust anyone over 30 to don't trust your parents to just get rid of your parents. This is a trajectory of development of ideology which is not very good and it doesn't lead to an ever larger movement. But this is common. What is it? What is it when people nowadays are moving from? You move very quickly politically. One day, look, the Panthers. One day, we're dealing. The honest truth, I knew some of these people. One day they're dealing heroin, the next day they're dealing Mao's little red book. That's quick, right? Overnight, one weekend, and you're moving from, you know, you're dealing drugs to you're dealing the little red book. Probably you haven't covered all the bases in the transition, right? We can understand it in that case. It's probably true that you're not yet the exemplary political revolutionary, and you need a little more time. Well, there's a lot of young people who travel a route that's almost that quick. And they need to understand that while it's highly exemplary and it can be courageous and everything else, it's also possible that you haven't quite yet picked up contact with everything that needs to be picked up. And there's a tendency to look down on too many people for too many reasons, for what they eat, for what they view, for what they like, for what they wear, for anything all over the place. And there are big things. One of the main things I learned, and it took me a long time to learn it. We used to, this is going to sound stupid, but we used to sleep on mattresses on the floor instead of mattresses in the bed. That was a big thing. You know, hair, blue jeans. By the way, blue jeans for the new left was so that it was really a uniform, right, that was cheap so that you didn't have distinguishing clothes where some were more expensive than others. That's the way it all started. But anyway, mattress on the floor or long hair. You go home to your parents, and you have a mattress on the floor, and you have long hair, and they have a heart attack. You have Karl Marx's Capital on under your arm, and they're a little bit disturbed. This is the way it was, right? It wasn't a big deal that we were reading Capital, but it was traumatic in the extreme if they came to visit and they saw the mattress on the floor. What the hell was your mattress doing on the floor? Right? What's going on here? Why is your hair so long? Now, there's similar things now, I'm sure, and I'm not in tune enough to know what they are. But what's going on? It's that some of the things that we did said to our parents, you're a shit. Your entire lifestyle eats it. Your entire lifestyle is wrong. Your entire lifestyle is the lifestyle of a bad human being. It threw that in their faces. Look at this. Sure, we could have a bed like you, but we have it on the floor right on you, right? You understand why our hair is long? Why isn't yours? Your whole life is a mistake. And you know what? Their whole lives weren't mistakes. We went too far. And it's important to realize that. And it makes it a lot easier to communicate with people if you're not communicating with them in a way that makes it seem like every single thing they do is wrong. Every single thing they do is backward. Every single thing they do is dumb. Every single thing they do is oppressive. It just doesn't open the conversation well, right? It just really doesn't get you off on a good footing. So somehow we have to find a way to retain the truth of our own aspirations and our own values without coming off as if everybody who we want to talk to is a banana boat. And that's really, really important. And that's a lesson that hasn't been learned because it's being recreated in the young people now, I think. And that it's not the fault of young people. It's the fault of old fogies. I don't know. Why don't if there's any does anybody have any questions before I go rambling on? Yeah.
Mind you, talking about the personal is political.
The personal is political. That was a product of the women's movement. When the personal is political came along, I think it was a brilliant, powerful insight. What was it saying? It was saying the personal. It was saying exactly what got the movements all started. In some sense, it was saying the personal pains that people feel have relationships to political phenomena in society. The poverty that we feel is a social product. But not just poverty, the fear that we feel, the lack of confidence that we feel, the lack of respect from others, but also the lack of respect for ourselves, the worry that we have, right? All this stuff, or if we're women, you know, they would sat around together and they discovered that everybody had the same damn problems. Everybody had the same damn pains. And in seeing the similarity, they realized it can't be that accidentally we all had the same thing due to our personal failings. It's a systemic thing. So the personal is political. We're saying that the personal dimension that we feel has political and social roots. Now it's become the political is personal. This is not a good inversion. Right? This is not a good inversion at all. For some people, to be political is to change one's personal self independently of anything else. It's a lifestyle problem. Now, I'm not saying that to make personal decisions about how one lives isn't a worthy thing to do or a good thing to do. It is. But the reversal is that it becomes paramount, and that it also it leads to a tremendous judgmentalism, right? And now we don't see it and understand it very well, because if I tell you that Chomsky wears Nike shoes, do you all decide not to listen to him? No. But if you see somebody in Nike shoes, you get, right, and you get, if it's at your own level, but it's no different. If wearing Nike shoes means you're a pig, then Chomsky's a pig if he wears Nike shoes. But he's not if he wears Nike shoes. He's not. It's not that big a thing. It might be good or it might be bad, but it isn't that much. We're missing the boat. What matters is whether you're part of the movement to deal with sweatshop labor. That's a whole different issue. It doesn't matter so much whether you eat or you don't eat beef when there's no beef movement, but it certainly matters when you if you eat or you don't eat beef when there's a, if there's a boycott that's a big, powerful movement against the industry. It's the difference between the personal is political, right, which is joining that movement, and the political is personal, which is bringing everything down to personal lifestyle. The person asked me about that phrase, and that's and I think the lesson, the personal is political, is a very powerful lesson. And maybe there's something to be said for the addition of the lesson that it's valuable to pay attention to our own behavior. But that's really not a new lesson. You know, people do know that. For some reason, it's hard for me to see any, but go ahead.
When you talk about leadership, mostly they evaluate Malcolm and his impact positively.
I hate to answer the question because I don't think I'm knowledgeable enough to know. But my experience of Malcolm was that he was trying to do some of these kinds. He was trying to speak. Malcolm was trying to win. A lot of people aren't. But he really was. So he talked about things like how people feel and anger and also doing things that are harmful to yourself, all sorts of things. I think he was really exemplary and powerful, my experience of him. But I don't have much experience of him. So I don't know how, you know, I can't really answer beyond that.
Relating to the political person, I think the people, and I agree with you, that people that take that stance tend to be judgmental, but they're exemplary in their own lives, but they try to carry it a little bit too far. The other side of that coin, though, is that some of them, at least, are addressing the issue of what we are familiar with, you know, talk the talk or walk the walk. Can you do both?
Well, it's easy enough to talk the talk. So, you know, walking the, but what does walking the walk mean? Does walking the walk mean walking without Nikes on or joining the movement and working in it? No, I think it means the latter. The former is okay, but minuscule, right? And not very difficult. I'm not so sure that it's so exemplary, right? I'm honestly not so sure that it's so exemplary because I suspect that what people are doing most of the time in this lifestyle dynamic is things that are quite comfortable for them to do. Right, I suspect that very little sacrifice is going on. That's not a criticism, right? But I think that they're probably not doing things that they don't want to do, that they don't like. It's not that there's an easy substitute. But walking the walk, i.e., joining the movement and taking the risks associated with it and doing all the onerous work, that is hard. That to me is more exemplary. So, you know, if Noam works 18 hours a week, or if Cynthia Peters works 18 hours a week, or somebody works 18 hours a week, or David is doing all that work, that's exemplary. If they're not wearing Nikes, I don't give a damn. I really don't. I just don't care, right, for me. That's maybe that's going too far, but, you know, I'm just telling you the truth.
I am a pacifist and nonviolent, I really appreciate your analysis and your, you know, talking about nonviolence and what I consider seeing it, the way you explained it, as a tactic and as the most practical and effective tactic that we can use. And I think that's a very good answer for people who don't understand the ramifications of what violence can do.
Yeah.
But for me, it also is an argument that violence begets violence, which is what I happen to think, and also because, for me, nonviolence is a way of life. And it is something that I strive to do in my personal life as much as I strive to do it in the tactics that I use when I am arrested.
Violence begets violence is a tactical argument, which I agree with. Okay?
And it's also, there's another, there's a guy named Wretched of the Earth, Frantz Fanon. He used to write this stuff, which is probably not being fair to him to say this, but this is how it percolates when it gets into the U.S. and people here start to think about it, which basically said violence is therapeutic. Right? So for the underclass, for the oppressed, violence is therapeutic because it releases all of the pent-up and repressed anger and there's an element of truth to that, but it would be good to accomplish it in some other way, especially if by becoming violent you're therapeutic and also smashed. So it's not, right? But the point is, I agree that violence has negative effects. And so if you have a movement and it has to have violence, like, say, going into Cuba and trying to deal with Batista, it's probably a good idea to have the people who perpetrate the violence not be the people who design the new society. And I think that's a sensible thing to do. But you should respect and appreciate the fact that they did what they did. So, for instance, when Stalin was robbing the banks, they should have been thankful to him for doing that and then put him out on a farm someplace rather than having him run the country and said, thank you. But wait, let me just finish a minute. Violence is a lifestyle. Here I disagree, and I don't want to debate back and forth, but this is the sense in which I disagree. I don't disagree with nonviolence as a lifestyle. I think it's the right lifestyle. But I think everybody thinks it's the right lifestyle. In a good society, of course, we all want to be nonviolent. I'm certainly not going to advocate violence as a virtue, right? Not by any means. So I am for nonviolence as a lifestyle, but I'm for a lot of things as a lifestyle. And the fact that we are fighting against who we're fighting against prevents us from doing a lot of the things that we would like to be doing in a good world. In a good world, I'd be a physicist. But I'm not a physicist. That's what I'd like to be. Somebody else wants to be nonviolent. I can't be a physicist and be effective politically as much as I'd like to be. So I dumped that and did this. See what I'm saying? So I agree with you as nonviolence as a lifestyle. I don't have any trouble understanding the virtues of that. And I weep if I have to be violent. But if the circumstances were such that and we should do that, right? We should cry. We shouldn't, in order to make violence easy, we shouldn't call the other side pigs, right? Which is the same as calling somebody a nigger in its purpose. The purpose is to dehumanize and to make it simple. And the reason we need to do that is because humans are not naturally violent. We're not pathological. We don't get fun out of hurting people. So what we do is make believe that the people who we're going to be violent toward aren't people. Clear? So we do it too. We do it too. We call them pigs. Now that's not a good idea, because now what's happening is violence is begetting dehumanization and everything else. So what we should really do is say, if we really had to be violent with the police, which I think is not a good tactic, but in Cuba, what they should have done is not said Batista's army is pigs. They should have said Batista's army is humans just like us. And when any of them die, it's a catastrophe. And we're going to have to kill them, and then we're going to go cry. Right? Now, that's very, very hard. Very, very hard. Right? But that's the best. And we aspire to do as good as we can. But that would be my view of it. But let me just say one last thing. Of all the people who I know in the U.S., probably the person who I would say I would admire most on the left is a nonviolent pacifist activist, which is Dave Dellinger. Right? I think his life is probably most exemplary for the last 50 or 60 years in the United States. And certainly, arguably so, certainly near the top. What's the sense of grading, right? But certainly near the top. So it isn't as if being a pacifist, to me, is a tremendous problem. If one has some additional features. Dave Dellinger supported the Black Panthers. Dave Dellinger supported the Weathermen. Dave Dellinger supported the NLF in Vietnam, though he was a pacifist. And he was a real pacifist. This was somebody who you know, you go at him and he's not going to put up his hands. You're going to have a very hard time fighting back if you're going at his family. And this is a guy who knew violence. So on Christmas Day, they're sitting around in a circle like this, and they're opening the presents, and he's about to open a present. And Dave had a taste for liquor. He liked his liquor, and he's got a bottle of, what is it called, Chivas Regal or something? I don't know. That's the expensive one, right? He's got the bottle of this expensive liquor, and his whole family is around him, and he's about to open it, but there's no card on it. And he pauses for a second. He looks closely, and something looks strange about it. There's this little tiny black line in it. And he decides to call the police, and they send the bomb squad, and they bring it out on the front lawn, and it's a bomb. And it would have blown up him and his family. He has seen violence in every form you can imagine, and he's still a total pacifist. So I couldn't have any more respect for this man in captivity. You know? but I just disagree with him on the tactical issue. But it disappears as an issue in the U.S., except for the fact that I would support, I might support defending the picket line. He wouldn't. He would just support something else.
Well, I think that, I mean, we could have an argument, and you've got the floor, but I appreciate what you say because you're not talking about proper, violence as being a good thing. If we have to kill people, we weep. But my vision is to get to the point where we don't have to do that.
Well, of course. So, that's mine too. That's mine too.
And to lead the examined life, which you obviously do, but some people don't, and to continue to do that, and to find as many ways as we possibly can to avoid violence.
Right. Well, to do what helps us create a better world,
right.
And you think that'll be avoiding violence, and most of the time it will be, I think. Go.
Continuing the thing of violence, you were talking about. Like, as armed struggle confirmed in the army, the whole point of guerrilla fighting or living in the colony, that you don't necessarily want to confront the army, so you do other kinds of actions to raise the social cost. And
And meanwhile, everybody else gets repressed. See, here's another part that I don't like about this stuff. Here's an example. You're at a demonstration, right, and it's a peaceful demonstration, and the weather people decide that we should raise the social cost by beating up a cop or something, or by doing something, which is not raising the social cost, by the way, because who the hell gives a damn? Do you think the elites give a damn, right? But they think that's a good idea. So they throw a rock at a cop, or they do something to provoke the cop, and then they get on their high horses because they've been practicing running for the last 9 weeks so they can avoid getting hit, and they take off. And who's left to get smashed, right? The people who came to the demonstration for the rally. And this is supposed to build a movement. Now, this is not going to build a movement. This kind of utter disregard for people who might be your allies, forget the other side, for people who might be the allies is no way to build a movement. It will not work. I see this again happening too. It's just a replication of the kind of stuff that they did. It's people getting so caught up in their interface with injustice that they are losing track of their interface with humanity. I don't know how to say it. I just don't quite know how to say it. But you gotta. It's bigger than that. And it isn't going to end tomorrow. This is a long struggle. That was also lost sight of. I mean, that's also a mistake of the 60s. All of a sudden, I got 6 months during which we're going to end this thing or something. There used to be, here's an interesting thing, you're going through the square, in my case, Harvard Square, and there's a guy on the corner, and he's selling a newspaper talking about how there's going to be a world war in 2 months, right? Nuclear war between China and Russia. This is one of these sects, geniuses. So he's selling a newspaper doing this, and I'm wondering to myself, if this guy is so damn sure that there's going to be a nuclear war in 2 months, why isn't he off on the beach someplace? What the hell is he doing selling the newspaper? What good is it going to do that he sold that newspaper? The actions are so inconsistent. They're so ridiculous. Sex. Here's some good positions for you from sex. No more sex because it interrupts, it takes away from the time that you have for revolution. This is a position. Progressive Labor Party. These people are smart people. They actually came up with this analysis. They began to analyze, we need as much time as we can. We got to put as much in as we possibly can. What are people doing that distracts? All of a sudden, no sex. Is a position. That's good. That was another recruitment boom. The next one is then there's another party. The RSC something or other? Maybe. I might get them mixed up. Doesn't matter. They've got this guy who's writing all their political position papers, right? And one of the political positions is that no gay can be involved in this organization. And the guy writing the papers is gay. And he's not even in the organization, right? And they've got him writing all the things because he's the smartest person they've got in the whole thing. But they won't let him in, but they'll use this thing. This kind of stuff happens. Now, I don't want to denigrate too much because I happen to think that the movements of the 60s were, one of the high points of the century. Literally one of the high points of the century, hard to match for a great many reasons. But it's important if we're going to try and find lessons, you've got to try and find weaknesses as well as strengths.
Can you talk a little bit about, I think you called it the stickiness problem, and what happened in the 60s after there's some just stayed active and involved and some really fell away, and what we can learn from that?
My notion of the sticky, we usually talk about, let me do preaching to the choir, too, while we're at it. We usually talk about the problem being that we preach to the choir, we don't reach out. Well, the first thing to get straight is that people on the left who are serious don't need to be told repeatedly that they preach to the choir. They probably know that they're having a hard time reaching further. So, for instance, if you're talking to people who do a political magazine on the left, or who publish books on the left, or who do a radio station, and you berate them for not for preaching to the choir, do you think you've really got some sort of insight that is, you know, that needs to be conveyed to them because they aren't aware of what their subscription level is and the difference between their subscription level and the entire population of the country? They probably know that. They're not preaching to the choir. They're not preaching to the choir. They don't have a goddamn megaphone that'll reach beyond the choir. Right? They're perfectly happy to preach anywhere, anytime, to anybody. They'll preach until the hell freezes over, but they have no megaphone to preach through. So if you want to tell them something, you could tell them you don't have a loud enough megaphone, but again, right, so what you really want to do is just give them some money to buy a bigger megaphone and stop with the other stuff. So that's the preaching of the choir. But the stickiness problem is more serious. And I actually was just thinking about this at one point, because we always think in terms of we don't have enough. We haven't reached enough people. So I sat down and said to myself, how many people have we reached? We never stop to think, how many people have we actually reached? And I tried to figure out, between 1967 and now, how many people have we reached? How many people had, to some degree, or even a relative, you know, been involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement, the hippie movement, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, the anti-nuke movement, all the local movements that have existed, the Gulf War, all of it, right? This is, huh? Central America, gay lesbian movement, everything, right? Everything. All the local communities, anything that's the left. Because what should happen? What should happen, it would seem to me, if we really have something good, is if we once get to somebody, lo and behold, we keep them. If we once get them, they like it. They stay. They want to become more and more deeply involved. So I tried to figure out how many people, I forget what I came up with as a conservative figure, but it's millions. Millions upon millions. And how many do we have right now who are serious leftists? Not that many. I think the stickiness problem might be much more the issue than the megaphone problem. The megaphone problem is very important. But if we had the stickiness problem solved, we'd be in very good shape. In other words, if everybody who passed through the left stayed in the left, or even a reasonable percentage of people who passed through the left stayed in the left. And I don't mean they stayed in the left just in the sense that, but they stayed in the left. But they really stayed in the left, and they really were involved in the left, then what would we have now? We'd have this massive left. And, of course, the more you have, the more you can reach out. Forget the megaphone problem. We could do it by word of mouth, right? So the problem becomes the stickiness problem, and then the next question becomes, well, why the hell don't people stay? And now you have to ask what that is. It's probably not because we're wrong. It's not because they all of a sudden thought that the world is nice. It's not that. It's that it's uncongenial. It's painful. They don't stay because they're in pain. And they're in more pain in the left than they are outside the left. And we have to face the fact. That's got to be the reason. It's got to be the reason. A few of them leave because they sell out. But that's not most of them. If that was most of them, I'd see all these people who I know running society and being at the top of NBC and ABC, and they're not there, right? They're just normal people. It's just that they got sick of being bashed in the left. Not bashed by police clubs, but bashed by their allies, bashed by each other. So the lesson here is that we need to create a movement which is congenial and which empowers us and which enriches our lives. Lives! Lives isn't just whether or not you understand a little bit of theory. Lives isn't just whether or not you went to a demonstration. Lives are broader than that. So the left has to give us a full life, especially since it takes away everything we had before. It seems, it seems to cause us to no longer be able to get any pleasure out of TV, sports, music, interrelations with other people, travel, any kind of consumer good, food. You know, you could get no pleasure out of anything, and so what do we give them?
In addition to this tremendous loss, what do we give them? Long meetings. We give them long meetings, and we give them somebody telling them that their lifestyle's all fucked up. Even though they got rid of all of that, they forgot to take off a sneaker or to, you know, whatever it is that they did, and so they still failed. That's another reason, by the way, for the lifestyle problem. Setting false standards. We set standards that are so fucking high that nobody can reach them, and then we beat ourselves in the head because we can't live up to them. Mistake. Big mistake. Set sane standards. Set sane goals. Smash them. Go beyond them. Transcend them. Do better than what we set. Don't set goals that are so high that we can't even come into the vicinity, right, which is what we tend to do. I hope that dealt with the question.